existential situation that no mere animal encounters or endures, and one of severity such that it would take a god to fully bear it. It is this sympathy that should be the proper medicament for self-conscious self-contempt, which has its justification, but is only half the full and proper story. Hatred for self and mankind must be balanced with gratefulness for tradition and the state, and astonishment at what normal everyday people accomplish, to say nothing of the staggering achievements of the truly remarkable. We deserve some respect. You deserve some respect. You're important to other people, as much as to yourself. You have some vital role to play in the unfolding destiny of the world. You are, therefore, morally obliged to take care of yourself. You should take care of, help, and be good to yourself, the same way you would take care of, help, and be good to someone you loved and valued. You may therefore have to conduct yourself habitually in a manner that allows you some respect for your own being, and fair enough. But every person is deeply flawed. Everyone falls short of the glory of God. If that stark fact meant, however, that we had no responsibility to care for ourselves as much as others, everyone would be brutally punished all the time. That would not be good. That would make the shortcomings of the world, which can make everyone who thinks honestly question the very propriety of the world, worse in every way. That simply cannot be the proper path forward. To treat yourself as if you were someone you were responsible for helping is, instead, to consider what would be truly good for you. This is not what you want. It is also not what would make you happy. Every time you give a child something sweet, you make that child happy. That does not mean that you should do nothing for children except feed them candy. Happy is by no means synonymous with good. You must get children to brush their teeth. They must put on their snowsuits when they go outside in the cold, even though they might object strenuously. You must help a child become a virtuous, responsible, awake being, capable of full reciprocity, able to take care of himself and others, and to thrive while doing so. Why would you think it acceptable to do anything less for yourself? You need to consider the future and think, what might my life look like if I were caring for myself properly? What career would challenge me and render me productive and helpful so that I could shoulder my share of the load and enjoy the consequences? What should I be doing when I have some freedom to improve my health, expand my knowledge, and strengthen my body? You need to know where you are so you can start to chart your course. You need to know who you are, so that you can understand your armament and bolster yourself in respect to your limitations. You need to know where you are going, so that you can limit the extent of chaos in your life, restructure order, and bring the divine force of hope to bear on the world. You must determine where you are going, so that you can bargain for yourself, so that you don't end up resentful, vengeful, and cruel. You have to articulate your own principles, so that you can defend yourself against others taking inappropriate advantage of you, and so that you are secure and safe while you work and play. You must discipline yourself carefully. You must keep the promises you make to yourself and reward yourself so that you can trust and motivate yourself. You need to determine how to act toward yourself so that you are most likely to become and to stay a good person. It would be good to make the world a better place. Heaven, after all, will not arrive of its own accord. We will have to work to bring it about and strengthen ourselves so that we can withstand the deadly angels and flaming sword of judgment that God used to bar its entrance. Don't underestimate the power of vision and direction. These are irresistible forces, able to transform what might appear to be unconquerable obstacles into traversable pathways and expanding opportunities. Strengthen the individual. Start with yourself. Take care with yourself. Define who you are. Refine your personality. choose your destination and articulate your being. As the great 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche so brilliantly noted, he whose life has a why can bear almost any how. You could help direct the world on its careening trajectory, a bit more toward heaven, and a bit more away from hell. Once having understood hell, researched it, so to speak, particularly your own individual hell, you could decide against going there or creating that. You could aim elsewhere. You could, in fact, devote your life to this. That would give you a meaning with a capital M. That would justify your miserable existence. That would atone for your sinful nature and replace your shame and self-consciousness with the natural pride and forthright confidence of someone who has learned once again to walk with God in the garden. You could begin by treating yourself as if you were someone you were responsible for helping. Rule 3. Make friends with people who want the best for you. The old hometown. The town I grew up in had been scraped only 50 years earlier out of the endless flat northern prairie. Fairview, Alberta, was part of the frontier and had the cowboy bars to prove it. The Hudson's Bay Company department store on Main Street still bought beaver, wolf, and coyote furs directly from the local trappers. 3,000 people lived there, 400 miles away from the nearest city. Cable TV, video games, and internet did not exist. It was no easy matter to stay innocently amused in Fairview, particularly during the 5 months of winter when long stretches of 40 below days and even colder nights were the norm. The world is a different place when it's cold like that. The drunks in our town ended their sad lives early. They passed out in snowbanks at 3 a.m. and froze to death. You don't go outside casually when it's 40 below. On first breath, the arid desert air constricts your lungs. Ice forms on your eyelashes, and they stick together. Long hair, wet from the shower, freezes solid and then stands on end, wraith-like of its own accord later in a warm house, when it thaws bone dry, charged with electricity. Children only put their tongues on steel playground equipment once. Smoke from house chimneys doesn't rise. Defeated by the cold, it drifts downwards and collects like fog on snow-covered rooftops and yards. Cars must be plugged in at night, their engines warmed by block heaters, or oil will not flow through them in the morning, and they won't start. Sometimes they won't anyway. Then you turn the engine over pointlessly until the starter clatters and falls silent. Then you remove the frozen battery from the car, loosening bolts with stiffening fingers in the intense cold, and bring it into the house. It sits there, sweating for hours, until it warms enough to hold a decent charge. You are not going to see out of the back window of your car, either. It frosts over in November and stays that way until May. Scraping it off just dampens the upholstery. Then it's frozen, too. Late one night, going to visit a friend, I sat for 2 hours on the edge of the passenger seat in a 1970 Dodge Challenger, jammed up against the stick shift, using a vodka-soaked rag to keep the inside of the front windshield clear in front of the driver because the car heater had quit. Stopping wasn't an option. There was nowhere to stop. And it was hell on house cats. Felines in Fairview had short ears and tails because they had lost the tips of both to frostbite. They came to resemble Arctic foxes, which evolved those features to deal proactively with the intense cold. One day our cat got outside and no one noticed. We found him, later, fur frozen fast to the cold, hard back door cement steps where he sat. We carefully separated cat from concrete, with no lasting damage, except to his pride. Fairview cats were also at great risk in the winter from cars, but not for the reasons you think. It wasn't automobiles sliding on icy roads and running them over. Only loser cats died that way. It was cars parked immediately after being driven that were dangerous. A frigid cat might think highly of climbing up under such a vehicle and sitting on its still warm engine block. But what if the driver decided to use the car again, before the engine cooled down and Cat departed? Let's just say that heat-seeking house pets and rapidly rotating radiator fans do not coexist happily. Because we were so far north, the bitterly cold winters were also very dark. By December, the sun didn't rise until 9:30 a.m. We trudged to school in the pitch black. It wasn't much lighter when we walked home, just before the early sunset. There wasn't much for young people to do in Fairview, even in the summer. But the winters were worse. Then your friends mattered, more than anything. My friend Chris and his cousin. I had a friend at that time. We'll call him Chris. He was a smart guy. He read a lot. He liked science fiction of the kind I was attracted to. Bradbury, Heinlein, Clark. He was inventive. He was interested in electronic kits and gears and motors. He was a natural engineer. All this was overshadowed, however, by something that had gone wrong in his family. I don't know what it was. His sisters were smart, and his father was soft-spoken, and his mother was kind. The girls seemed okay. But Chris had been left unattended to in some important way. Despite his intelligence and curiosity, he was angry, resentful, and without hope. All this manifested itself in material form in the shape of his 1972 blue Ford pickup truck. That notorious vehicle had at least one dent in every quarter panel of its damaged external body. Worse, it had an equivalent number of dents inside. Those were produced by the impact of the body parts of friends against the internal surfaces during the continual accidents that resulted in the outer dents. Chris's truck was the exoskeleton of a nihilist. It had the perfect bumper sticker. Be alert. The world needs more alerts. The irony it produced in combination with the dents elevated it nicely to theater of the absurd. Very little of that was, so to speak, accidental. Every time Chris crashed his truck, his father would fix it and buy him something else. He had a motorbike and a van for selling ice cream. He did not care for his motorbike. He sold no ice cream. He often expressed dissatisfaction with his father in their relationship. But his dad was older and unwell, diagnosed with an illness only after many years. He didn't have the energy he should have. Maybe he couldn't pay enough attention to his son. Maybe that's all it took to fracture their relationship. Chris had a cousin, Ed, who was about 2 years younger. I liked him, as much as you can like the younger cousin of a teenage friend. He was a tall, smart, charming, good-looking kid. He was witty, too. You would have predicted a good future for him had you met him when he was 12. But Ed drifted slowly downhill into a dropout, semi-drifting mode of existence. He didn't get as angry as Chris, but he was just as confused. If you knew Ed's friends, you might say that it was peer pressure that set him on his downward path. But his peers weren't obviously any more lost or delinquent than he was, although they were generally somewhat less bright. It was also the case that Ed's and Chris's situation did not appear particularly improved by their discovery of marijuana. Marijuana isn't bad for everyone, any more than alcohol is bad for everyone. Sometimes it even appears to improve people. But it didn't improve Ed. Didn't improve Chris either. To amuse ourselves in the long nights, Chris and I and Ed and the rest of the teenagers drove around and around in our 1970s cars and pickup trucks. We cruised down Main Street, along Railroad Avenue, up past the high school, around the north end of town, over to the west. Or up Main Street, around the north end of town, over to the east, and so on, endlessly repeating the theme. If we weren't driving in town, we were driving in the countryside. A century earlier, surveyors had laid out a vast grid across the entire 300,000-square-mile expanse of the Great Western Prairie. Every 2 miles north, a plowed gravel road stretched forever, east to west. Every mile west, another traveled north and south. We never ran out of roads. Teenage Wasteland. If we weren't circling around town and countryside, we were at a party. Some relatively young adult, or some relatively creepy older adult, would open his house to friends. It would then become temporary home to all manner of party crashers, many of whom started out seriously undesirable, or quickly became that way when drinking. A party might also happen accidentally when some teenager's unwitting parents had left town. In that case, the occupants of the cars or trucks always cruising around would notice house lights on but household car absent. This was not good. Things could get seriously out of hand. I did not like teenage parties. I do not remember them nostalgically. They were dismal affairs. The lights were kept low. That kept self-consciousness to a minimum. The overloud music made conversation impossible. There was little to talk about in any case. There were always a couple of the town's psychopaths attending. Everybody drank and smoked too much. A dreary and oppressive sense of aimlessness hung over such occasions, and nothing ever happened, unless you count the time my too quiet classmate drunkenly began to brandish his fully loaded 12-gauge shotgun, or the time the girl I later married contemptuously insulted someone while he threatened her with a knife, or the time another friend climbed a large tree, swung out on a branch, and crashed flat onto his back, half dead, right beside the campfire we had started at its base, followed precisely 1 minute later by his half-wit sidekick. No one knew what the hell they were doing at those parties. Hoping for a cheerleader? Waiting for Godot? Although the former would have been immediately preferred, although cheerleading squads were scarce in our town, the latter was closer to the truth. It would be more romantic, I suppose, to suggest that we would have all jumped at the chance for something more productive, bored out of our skulls as we were. But it's not true. We were all too prematurely cynical and world-weary and leery of responsibility to stick to the debating clubs and air cadets and school sports that the adults around us tried to organize. Doing anything wasn't cool. I don't know what teenage life was like before the revolutionaries of the late 60s advised everyone young to tune in, turn on, and drop out. Was it okay for a teenager to belong wholeheartedly to a club in 1955? Because it certainly wasn't 20 years later. Plenty of us turned on and dropped out, but not so many tuned in. I wanted to be elsewhere. I wasn't the only one. Everyone who eventually left the Fairview I grew up in knew they were leaving by the age of 12. I knew. My wife, who grew up with me on the street our family shared, knew. The friends I had who did and didn't leave also knew, regardless of which track they were on. There was an unspoken expectation in the families of those who were college-bound that such a thing was a matter of course. For those from less educated families, a future that included university was simply not part of the conceptual realm. It wasn't for lack of money, either. Tuition for advanced education was very low at that time, and jobs in Alberta were plentiful and high-paying. I earned more money in 1980 working at a plywood mill than I would again doing anything else for 20 years. No one missed out on university because of financial need in oil-rich Alberta in the 1970s. Some different friends, and some more of the same. In high school, after my first group of cronies had all dropped out, I made friends with a couple of newcomers. They came to Fairview as boarders. There was no school after ninth grade in their even more remote and aptly named hometown, Bear Canyon. They were an ambitious duo, comparatively speaking, straightforward and reliable, but also cool and very amusing. When I left town to attend Grand Prairie Regional College, 90 miles away, one of them became my roommate. The other went off elsewhere to pursue further education. Both were aiming upward. Their decisions to do so bolstered mine. I was a happy clam when I arrived at college. I found another expanded group of like-minded companions, whom my Bear Canyon comrade also joined. We were all captivated by literature and philosophy. We ran the student union. We made it profitable for the first time in its history, hosting college dances. How can you lose money selling beer to college kids? We started a newspaper. We got to know our professors of political science and biology and English literature in the tiny seminars that characterized even our first year. The instructors were thankful for our enthusiasm and taught us well. We were building a better life. I sloughed off a lot of my past. In a small town, everyone knows who you are. You drag your years behind you like a running dog with tin cans tied to its tail. You can't escape who you have been. Everything wasn't online then, and thank God for that. But it was stored equally indelibly in everyone's spoken and unspoken expectations and memory. When you move, everything is up in the air, at least for a while. It's stressful, but in the chaos there are new possibilities. People, including you, can't hem you in with their old notions. You get shaken out of your ruts. You can make new, better ruts with people aiming at better things. I thought this was just a natural development. I thought that every person who moved would have, and want, the same phoenix-like experience. But that wasn't always the case. One time when I was about 15, I went with Chris and another friend, Carl, to Edmonton, a city of 600,000. Carl had never been to a city. This was not uncommon. Fairview to Edmonton was an 800-mile round trip. I had done it many times, sometimes with my parents, sometimes without. I liked the anonymity that the city provided. I liked the new beginnings. I liked the escape from the dismal, cramped adolescent culture of my hometown. So I convinced my two friends to make the journey. But they did not have the same experience. As soon as we arrived, Chris and Carl wanted to buy some pot. We headed for the parts of Edmonton that were exactly like the worst of Fairview. We found the same furtive street vending marijuana providers. We spent the weekend drinking in the hotel room. Although we had traveled a long distance, we had gone nowhere at all. I saw an even more egregious example of this a few years later. I had moved to Edmonton to finish my undergraduate degree. I took an apartment with my sister, who was studying to be a nurse. She was also an up-and-out-of-there person. Not too many years later, she would plant strawberries in Norway and run safaris through Africa and smuggle trucks across the Tuareg-menaced Sahara Desert and babysit orphan gorillas in the Congo. We had a nice place in a new high-rise, overlooking the broad valley of the North Saskatchewan River. We had a view of the city's skyline in the background. I bought a beautiful new Yamaha upright piano in a fit of enthusiasm. The place looked good. I heard through the grapevine that Ed, Chris's younger cousin, had moved to the city. I thought that was a good thing. One day he called. I invited him over. I wanted to see how he was faring. I hoped he was achieving some of the potential I once saw in him. That is not what happened. Ed showed up, older, balder, and stooped. He was a lot more not-doing-so-well young adult and a lot less youthful possibility. His eyes were the telltale red slits of the practiced stoner. Ed had taken some job, lawn mowing and casual landscaping, which would have been fine for a part-time university student or for someone who could not do better, but which was wretchedly low-end as a career for an intelligent person. He was accompanied by a friend. It was his friend I really remember. He was spaced. He was baked. He was stoned out of his gourd. His head in our nice civilized apartment did not easily occupy the same universe. My sister was there. She knew Ed. She'd seen this sort of thing before. But I still wasn't happy that Ed had brought this character into our place. Ed sat down. His friend sat down, too, although it wasn't clear he noticed. It was tragicomedy. Stoned as he was, Ed still had the sense to be embarrassed. We sipped our beer. Ed's friend looked upwards. "My particles are scattered all over the ceiling," he managed. Truer words were never spoken. I took Ed aside and told him politely that he had to leave. I said that he shouldn't have brought his useless bastard of a companion. He nodded. He understood. That made it even worse. His older cousin Chris wrote me a letter much later about such things. I included it in my first book, Maps of Meaning, The Architecture of Belief, published in 1999. "I had friends," he said, "before. Anyone with enough self-contempt that they could forgive me mine." What was it that made Chris and Carl and Ed unable, or worse, perhaps unwilling, to move or to change their friendships and improve the circumstances of their lives? Was it inevitable, a consequence of their own limitations, nascent illnesses, and traumas of the past? After all, people vary significantly, in ways that seem both structural and deterministic. People differ in intelligence, which is in large part the ability to learn and transform. People have very different personalities as well. Some are active, and some passive. Others are anxious or calm. For every individual driven to achieve, there is another who is indolent. The degree to which these differences are immutably part and parcel of someone is greater than an optimist might presume or desire. And then there is illness, mental and physical, diagnosed or invisible, further limiting or shaping our lives. Chris had a psychotic break in his 30s after flirting with insanity for many years. Not long afterward, he committed suicide. Did his heavy marijuana use play a magnifying role? Or was it understandable self-medication? Use of physician-prescribed drugs for pain has, after all, decreased in marijuana legal states such as Colorado. Maybe the pot made things better for Chris, not worse. Maybe it eased his suffering instead of exacerbating his instability. Was it the nihilistic philosophy he nurtured that paved the way to his eventual breakdown? Was that nihilism, in turn, a consequence of genuine ill health, or just an intellectual rationalization of his unwillingness to dive responsibly into life? Why did he, like his cousin, like my other friends, continually choose people who and places that were not good for him? Sometimes, when people have a low opinion of their own worth, or perhaps when they refuse responsibility for their lives, they choose a new acquaintance of precisely the type who proved troublesome in the past. Such people don't believe that they deserve any better, so they don't go looking for it. Or perhaps they don't want the trouble of better. Freud called this a repetition compulsion. He thought of it as an unconscious drive to repeat the horrors of the past, sometimes perhaps to formulate those horrors more precisely, sometimes to attempt more active mastery, and sometimes perhaps because no alternatives beckon. People create their worlds with the tools they have directly at hand. Faulty tools produce faulty results. Repeated use of the same faulty tools produces the same faulty results. It is in this manner that those who fail to learn from the past doom themselves to repeat it. It's partly fate. It's partly inability. It's partly unwillingness to learn? Refusal to learn? Motivated refusal to learn? Rescuing the damned. People choose friends who aren't good for them for other reasons, too. Sometimes it's because they want to rescue someone. This is more typical of young people, although the impetus still exists among older folks who are too agreeable or have remained naive or who are willfully blind. Someone might object. It is only right to see the best in people. The highest virtue is the desire to help. But not everyone who is failing is a victim. And not everyone at the bottom wishes to rise, although many do, and many manage it. Nonetheless, people will often accept or even amplify their own suffering as well as that of others if they can brandish it as evidence of the world's injustice. There is no shortage of oppressors among the downtrodden, even if, given their lowly positions, many of them are only tyrannical wannabes. It's the easiest path to choose, moment to moment, although it's nothing but hell in the long run. Imagine someone not doing well. He needs help. He might even want it. But it is not easy to distinguish between someone truly wanting and needing help and someone who is merely exploiting a willing helper. The distinction is difficult even for the person who is wanting and needing and possibly exploiting. The person who tries and fails and is forgiven and then tries again and fails and is forgiven is also too often the person who wants everyone to believe in the authenticity of all that trying. When it's not just naivety, the attempt to rescue someone is often fueled by vanity and narcissism. Something like this is detailed in the incomparable Russian author Fyodor Dostoevsky's bitter classic, Notes from Underground, which begins with these famous lines. I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man. I am an unattractive man. I believe my liver is diseased. It is the confession of a miserable, arrogant sojourner in the underworld of chaos and despair. He analyzes himself mercilessly, but only pays in this manner for 100 sins, despite committing 1,000. Then, imagining himself redeemed, the underground man commits the worst transgression of the lot. He offers aid to a genuinely unfortunate person, Liza, a woman on the desperate 19th century road to prostitution. He invites her for a visit, promising to set her life back on the proper course. While waiting for her to appear, his fantasies spin increasingly messianic. One day passed, however, another and another. She did not come, and I began to grow calmer. I felt particularly bold and cheerful after 9 o'clock. I even sometimes began dreaming, and rather sweetly. I, for instance, became the salvation of Liza, simply through her coming to me and my talking to her. I develop her, educate her. Finally, I notice that she loves me passionately. I pretend not to understand. I don't know, however, why I pretend. Just for effect, perhaps. At last, all confusion, transfigured, trembling and sobbing, she flings herself at my feet and says that I am her savior, and that she loves me better than anything in the world. Nothing but the narcissism of the underground man is nourished by such fantasies. Liza herself is demolished by them. The salvation he offers to her demands far more in the way of commitment and maturity than the underground man is willing or able to offer. He simply does not have the character to see it through, something he quickly realizes and equally quickly rationalizes. Liza eventually arrives at his shabby apartment, hoping desperately for a way out, staking everything she has on the visit. She tells the underground man that she wants to leave her current life. His response? "Why have you come to me? Tell me that, please," I began, gasping for breath and regardless of logical connection in my words. I longed to have it all out at once, at one burst. I did not even trouble how to begin. "Why have you come? Answer! Answer!" I cried, hardly knowing what I was doing. "I'll tell you, my good girl, why you have come. You've come because I talked sentimental stuff to you then, so now you're as soft as butter and longing for fine sentiments again. So you may as well know that I was laughing at you then, and I'm laughing at you now. Why are you shuddering?" "Yes, I was laughing at you. I had been insulted just before at dinner by the fellows who came that evening before me. I came to you, meaning to thrash one of them, an officer. But I didn't succeed. I didn't find him. I had to avenge the insult on someone to get back my own again. You turned up. I vented my spleen on you and laughed at you. I had been humiliated, so I wanted to humiliate. I had been treated like a rag, so I wanted to show my power. That's what it was. And you imagined I had come there on purpose to save you? Yes? You imagined that? You imagined that?" I knew that she would perhaps be muddled and not take it all in exactly, but I knew, too, that she would grasp the gist of it very well indeed. And so, indeed, she did. She turned white as a handkerchief, tried to say something, and her lips worked painfully, but she sank on a chair as though she had been felled by an axe. And all the time afterwards, she listened to me with her lips parted and her eyes wide open, shuddering with awful terror. The cynicism of my words overwhelmed her. The inflated self-importance, carelessness, and sheer malevolence of the underground man dashes Liza's last hopes. He understands this well. Worse, something in him was aiming at this all along, and he knows that too. But a villain who despairs of his villainy has not become a hero. A hero is something positive, not just the absence of evil. But Christ himself, you might object, befriended tax collectors and prostitutes. How dare I cast aspersions on the motives of those who were trying to help? But Christ was the archetypal perfect man, and you're you. How do you know that your attempts to pull someone up won't instead bring them or you further down? Imagine the case of someone supervising an exceptional team of workers, all of them striving towards a collectively held goal. Imagine them hardworking, brilliant, creative and unified. But the person supervising is also responsible for someone troubled who's performing poorly elsewhere. In a fit of inspiration, the well-meaning manager moves that problematic person into the midst of his stellar team, hoping to improve him by example. What happens? And the psychological literature is clear on this point. Does the errant interloper immediately straighten up and fly right? No. Instead, the entire team degenerates. The newcomer remains cynical, arrogant, and neurotic. He complains. He shirks. He misses important meetings. His low-quality work causes delays and must be redone by others. He still gets paid, however, just like his teammates. The hard workers who surround him start to feel betrayed. Why am I breaking myself into pieces, striving to finish this project, each thinks, when my new team member never breaks a sweat? The same thing happens when well-meaning counselors place a delinquent teen among comparatively civilized peers. The delinquency spreads, not the stability. Down is a lot easier than up. Maybe you are saving someone because you're a strong, generous, well-put-together person who wants to do the right thing. But it's also possible, and perhaps more likely, that you just want to draw attention to your inexhaustible reserves of compassion and goodwill. Or maybe you're saving someone because you want to convince yourself that the strength of your character is more than just a side effect of your luck and birthplace. Or maybe it's because it's easier to look virtuous when standing alongside someone utterly irresponsible. Assume first that you're doing the easiest thing and not the most difficult. Your raging alcoholism makes my binge drinking appear trivial. My long serious talks with you about your badly failing marriage convinced both of us that you are doing everything possible and that I am helping you to my utmost. It looks like effort. It looks like progress. But real improvement would require far more from both of you. Are you so sure the person crying out to be saved has not decided 1,000 times to accept his lot of pointless and worsening suffering simply because it is easier than shouldering any true responsibility? Are you enabling a delusion? Is it possible that your contempt would be more salutary than your pity? Or maybe you have no plan, genuine or otherwise, to rescue anybody. You're associating with people who are bad for you, not because it's better for anyone, but because it's easier. You know it. Your friends know it. You're all bound by an implicit contract, one aimed at nihilism and failure and suffering of the stupidest sort. You've all decided to sacrifice the future to the present. You don't talk about it. You don't all get together and say, let's take the easier path. Let's indulge in whatever the moment might bring. And let's agree further not to call each other on it. That way we can more easily forget what we are doing. You don't mention any of that. But you all know what's really going on. Before you help someone, you should find out why that person is in trouble. You shouldn't merely assume that he or she is a noble victim of unjust circumstances and exploitation. It's the most unlikely explanation, not the most probable. In my experience, clinical and otherwise, it's just never been that simple. Besides, if you buy the story that everything terrible just happened on its own with no personal responsibility on the part of the victim, you deny that person all agency in the past, and by implication, in the present and future as well. In this manner, you strip him or her of all power. It is far more likely that a given individual has just decided to reject the path upward because of its difficulty. Perhaps that should even be your default assumption when faced with such a situation. That's too harsh, you think. You might be right. Maybe that's a step too far. But consider this. Failure is easy to understand. No explanation for its existence is required. In the same manner, fear, hatred, addiction, promiscuity, betrayal, and deception require no explanation. It's not the existence of vice or the indulgence in it that requires explanation. Vice is easy. Failure is easy, too. It's easier not to shoulder a burden. It's easier not to think and not to do and not to care. It's easier to put off until tomorrow what needs to be done today and drown the upcoming months and years in today's cheap pleasures. As the infamous father of the Simpson clan puts it, immediately prior to downing a jar of mayonnaise and vodka. That's a problem for future Homer. Man, I don't envy that guy. How do I know that your suffering is not the demand of martyrdom for my resources so that you can also momentarily stave off the inevitable? Maybe you have even moved beyond caring about the impending collapse, but don't yet want to admit it. Maybe my help won't rectify anything. Can't rectify anything. but it does keep that too terrible, too personal realization temporarily at bay. Maybe your misery is a demand placed on me so that I fail too, so that the gap you so painfully feel between us can be reduced while you degenerate and sink. How do I know that you would refuse to play such a game? How do I know that I am not myself merely pretending to be responsible while pointlessly helping you so that I don't have to do something truly difficult and genuinely possible? Maybe your misery is the weapon you brandish in your hatred for those who rose upward while you waited and sank. Maybe your misery is your attempt to prove the world's injustice instead of the evidence of your own sin, your own missing of the mark, your conscious refusal to strive and to live. Maybe your willingness to suffer in failure is inexhaustible, given what you use that suffering to prove. Maybe it's your revenge on being. How exactly should I befriend you when you're in such a place? How exactly could I? Success. That's the mystery. Virtue. That's what's inexplicable. To fail, you merely have to cultivate a few bad habits. You just have to bide your time. And once someone has spent enough time cultivating bad habits and biding their time, they're much diminished. Much of what they could have been has dissipated, and much of the less that they have become is now real. Things fall apart of their own accord, but the sins of men speed their degeneration. And then comes the flood. I'm not saying that there's no hope of redemption, but it is much harder to extract someone from a chasm than to lift him from a ditch. And some chasms are very deep, and there's not much left of the body at the bottom. Maybe I should at least wait to help you until it's clear that you want to be helped. Carl Rogers, the famous humanistic psychologist, believed it was impossible to start a therapeutic relationship if the person seeking help did not want to improve. Rogers believed it was impossible to convince someone to change for the better. The desire to improve was instead the precondition for progress. I've had court-mandated psychotherapy clients. They did not want my help. They were forced to seek it. It did not work. It was a travesty. If I stay in an unhealthy relationship with you, perhaps it's because I'm too weak-willed and indecisive to leave, but I don't want to know it. Thus, I continue helping you and console myself with my pointless martyrdom. Maybe I can then conclude about myself. Someone that self-sacrificing, that willing to help someone, that has to be a good person. Not so. It might be just a person trying to look good, pretending to solve what appears to be a difficult problem, instead of actually being good and addressing something real. Maybe instead of continuing our friendship, I should just go off somewhere, get my act together, and lead by example. And none of this is a justification for abandoning those in real need to pursue your narrow, blind ambition, in case it has to be said. A reciprocal arrangement. Here's something to consider. If you have a friend whose friendship you wouldn't recommend to your sister or your father or your son, why would you have such a friend for yourself? You might say, out of loyalty. Well, loyalty is not identical to stupidity. Loyalty must be negotiated fairly and honestly. Friendship is a reciprocal arrangement. You are not morally obliged to support someone who is making the world a worse place. Quite the opposite. You should choose people who want things to be better, not worse. It's a good thing, not a selfish thing, to choose people who are good for you. It's appropriate and praiseworthy to associate with people whose lives would be improved if they saw your life improve. If you surround yourself with people who support your upward aim, they will not tolerate your cynicism and destructiveness. They will instead encourage you when you do good for yourself and others and punish you carefully when you do not. This will help bolster your resolve to do what you should do in the most appropriate and careful manner. People who are not aiming up will do the opposite. They will offer a former smoker a cigarette and a former alcoholic a beer. They will become jealous when you succeed or do something pristine. They will withdraw their presence or support or actively punish you for it. They will override your accomplishment with a past action, real or imaginary, of their own. Maybe they're trying to test you, to see if your resolve is real, to see if you are genuine. But mostly they are dragging you down, because your new improvements cast their faults in an even dimmer light. It is for this reason that every good example is a fateful challenge, and every hero a judge. Michelangelo's great, perfect marble David cries out to its observer, "You could be more than you are." When you dare aspire upward, you reveal the inadequacy of the present and the promise of the future. Then you disturb others in the depths of their souls, where they understand that their cynicism and immobility are unjustifiable. You play Abel to their Cain. You remind them that they ceased caring not because of life's horrors, which are undeniable, but because they do not want to lift the world up onto their shoulders, where it belongs. Don't think that it's easier to surround yourself with good, healthy people than with bad, unhealthy people. It's not. A good, healthy person is an ideal. It requires strength and daring to stand up near such a person. Have some humility. Have some courage. Use your judgment and protect yourself from too uncritical compassion and pity. Make friends with people who want the best for you. Rule 4. Compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today. The internal critic. It was easier for people to be good at something when more of us lived in small, rural communities. Someone could be homecoming queen. Someone else could be spelling bee champ, math whiz, or basketball star. There were only one or two mechanics and a couple of teachers. In each of their domains, these local heroes had the opportunity to enjoy the serotonin-fueled confidence of the victor. It may be for that reason that people who were born in small towns are statistically overrepresented among the eminent. If you're one in a million now, but originated in modern New York, there's 20 of you, and most of us now live in cities. What's more, we've become digitally connected to the entire 7 billion. Our hierarchies of accomplishment are now dizzyingly vertical. No matter how good you are at something, or how you rank your accomplishments, there is someone out there who makes you look incompetent. You're a decent guitar player, but you're not Jimmy Page or Jack White. You're almost certainly not even going to rock your local pub. You're a good cook, but there are many great chefs. Your mother's recipe for fish heads and rice, no matter how celebrated in her village of origin, doesn't cut it in these days of grapefruit foam and scotch tobacco ice cream. Some mafia don has a tackier yacht. Some obsessive CEO has a more complicated self-winding watch, kept in his more valuable mechanical hardwood and steel automatic self-winding watch case. Even the most stunning Hollywood actress eventually transforms into the evil queen on eternal paranoid watch for the new Snow White. And you? Your career is boring and pointless. Your housekeeping skills are second rate. Your taste is appalling. You're fatter than your friends. And everyone dreads your parties. Who cares if you are Prime Minister of Canada when someone else is the President of the United States? Inside us dwells a critical internal voice and spirit that knows all this. It's predisposed to make its noisy case. It condemns our mediocre efforts. It can be very difficult to quell. Worse, critics of its sort are necessary. There's no shortage of tasteless artists, tuneless musicians, poisonous cooks, bureaucratically personality-disordered middle managers, hack novelists, and tedious ideology-ridden professors. Things and people differ importantly in their qualities. Awful music torments listeners everywhere. Poorly designed buildings crumble in earthquakes. Substandard automobiles kill their drivers when they crash. Failure is the price we pay for standards. And because mediocrity has consequences both real and harsh, standards are necessary. We are not equal in ability or outcome, and never will be. A very small number of people produce very much of everything. The winners don't take all, but they take most, and the bottom is not a good place to be. People are unhappy at the bottom. They get sick there and remain unknown and unloved. They waste their lives there. They die there. In consequence, the self-denigrating voice in the minds of people weaves a devastating tale. Life is a zero-sum game. Worthlessness is the default condition. What but willful blindness could possibly shelter people from such withering criticism? It is for such reasons that a whole generation of social psychologists recommended positive illusions as the only reliable route to mental health. Their credo? Let a lie be your umbrella. A more dismal, wretched, pessimistic philosophy can hardly be imagined. Things are so terrible that only delusion can save you. Here's an alternative approach, and one that requires no illusions. If the cards are always stacked against you, perhaps the game you are playing is somehow rigged. Perhaps by you, unbeknownst to yourself. If the internal voice makes you doubt the value of your endeavors, or your life, or life itself, perhaps you should stop listening. If the critical voice within says the same denigrating things about everyone, no matter how successful, how reliable can it be? Maybe its comments are chatter, not wisdom. There will always be people better than you. That's a cliche of nihilism. Like the phrase, in a million years, who's going to know the difference? The proper response to that statement is not, well then, everything is meaningless. It's, any idiot can choose a frame of time within which nothing matters. Talking yourself into irrelevance is not a profound critique of being. It's a cheap trick of the rational mind. Many good games. Standards of better or worse are not illusory or unnecessary. If you hadn't decided that what you were doing right now was better than the alternatives, you wouldn't be doing it. The idea of a value-free choice is a contradiction in terms. Value judgments are a precondition for action. Furthermore, every activity, once chosen, comes with its own internal standards of accomplishment. If something can be done at all, it can be done better or worse. To do anything at all is therefore to play a game with a defined and valued end, which can always be reached more or less efficiently and elegantly. Every game comes with its chance of success or failure. Differentials in quality are omnipresent. Furthermore, if there was no better and worse, nothing would be worth doing. There would be no value, and, therefore, no meaning. Why make an effort if it doesn't improve anything? Meaning itself requires the difference between better and worse. How, then, can the voice of critical self-consciousness be stilled? Where are the flaws in the apparently impeccable logic of its message? We might start by considering the all-too black-and-white words themselves. Success or failure? You are either a success, a comprehensive, singular, overall good thing, or its opposite, a failure, a comprehensive, singular, irredeemably bad thing. The words imply no alternative and no middle ground. However, in a world as complex as ours, such generalizations, really such failure to differentiate, are a sign of naive, unsophisticated, or even malevolent analysis. There are vital degrees and gradations of value obliterated by this binary system, and the consequences are not good. To begin with, there's not just one game at which to succeed or fail. There are many games, and more specifically, many good games. Games that match your talents, involve you productively with other people, and sustain and even improve themselves across time. Lawyer is a good game. So is plumber, physician, carpenter, or school teacher. The world allows for many ways of being. If you don't succeed at one, you can try another. You can pick something better matched to your unique mix of strengths, weaknesses, and situation. Furthermore, if changing games does not work, you can invent a new one. I recently watched a talent show featuring a mime who taped his mouth shut and did something ridiculous with oven mitts. That was unexpected. That was original. Seemed to be working for him. It's also unlikely that you're playing only one game. You have a career and friends and family members and personal projects and artistic endeavors and athletic pursuits. You might consider judging your success across all the games you play. Imagine that you're very good at some, middling at others, and terrible at the remainder. Perhaps that's how it should be. You might object, I should be winning at everything. But winning at everything might only mean that you're not doing anything new or difficult. You might be winning, but you're not growing. And growing might be the most important form of winning. Should victory in the present always take precedence over trajectory across time? Finally, you might come to realize that the specifics of the many games you are playing are so unique to you, so individual, that comparison to others is simply inappropriate. Perhaps you are overvaluing what you don't have and undervaluing what you do. There's some real utility in gratitude. It's also good protection against the dangers of victimhood and resentment. Your colleague outperforms you at work. His wife, however, is having an affair, while your marriage is stable and happy. Who has it better? The celebrity you admire is a chronic drunk driver and bigot. Is his life truly preferable to yours? When the internal critic puts you down using such comparisons, here's how it operates. First, it selects a single arbitrary domain of comparison. Fame, maybe, or power. Then it acts as if that domain is the only one that is relevant. Then it contrasts you unfavorably with someone truly stellar within that domain. It can take that final step even further, using the unbridgeable gap between you and its target of comparison as evidence for the fundamental injustice of life. That way, your motivation to do anything at all can be most effectively undermined. Those who accept such an approach to self-evaluation certainly can't be accused of making things too easy for themselves, but it's just as big a problem to make things too difficult. When we are very young, we are neither individual nor informed. We have not had the time nor gained the wisdom to develop our own standards. In consequence, we must compare ourselves to others because standards are necessary. Without them, there's nowhere to go and nothing to do. As we mature, we become, by contrast, increasingly individual and unique. The conditions of our lives become more and more personal and less comparable with those of others. Symbolically speaking, this means we must leave the house ruled by our father and confront the chaos of our individual being. We must take note of our disarray without completely abandoning that father in the process. We must then rediscover the values of our culture, veiled from us by our ignorance, hidden in the dusty treasure trove of the past, rescue them, and integrate them into our own lives. This is what gives existence its full and necessary meaning. Who are you? You think you know. Maybe you don't. You are, for example, neither your own master nor your own slave. You cannot easily tell yourself what to do and compel your own obedience, any more than you can easily tell your husband, wife, son, or daughter what to do and compel theirs. You're interested in some things and not in others. You can shape that interest. But there are limits. Some activities will always engage you and others simply will not. You have a nature. You can play the tyrant to it, but you will certainly rebel. How hard can you force yourself to work and sustain your desire to work? How much can you sacrifice to your partner before generosity turns to resentment? What is it that you actually love? What is it that you genuinely want? Before you can articulate your own standards of value, you must see yourself as a stranger, and then you must get to know yourself. What do you find valuable or pleasurable? How much leisure, enjoyment, and reward do you require so that you feel like more than a beast of burden? How must you treat yourself so you won't kick over the traces and smash up your corral? You could force yourself through your daily grind and kick your dog in frustration when you come home. You could watch the precious days tick by. Or you could learn how to entice yourself into sustainable, productive activity. Do you ask yourself what you want? Do you negotiate fairly with yourself? Or are you a tyrant with yourself as slave? When do you dislike your parents, your spouse, or your children, and why? What might be done about that? What do you need and want from your friends and your business partners? This is not a mere matter of what you should want. I'm not talking about what other people require from you or your duties to them. I'm talking about determining the nature of your moral obligation to yourself. Should might enter into it because you're nested within a network of social obligations. Should is your responsibility, and you should live up to it. But this does not mean you must take the role of lapdog, obedient and harmless. That's how a dictator wants his slaves. Dare instead to be dangerous. Dare to be truthful. Dare to articulate yourself and express, or at least become aware of, what would really justify your life. If you allowed your dark and unspoken desires for your partner, for example, to manifest themselves, if you were even willing to consider them, you might discover that they were not so dark given the light of day. You might discover instead that you were just afraid, and so pretending to be moral. You might find that getting what you actually desire would stop you from being tempted and straying. Are you so sure that your partner would be unhappy if more of you rose to the surface? The femme fatale and the anti-hero are sexually attractive for a reason. How do you need to be spoken to? What do you need to take from people? What are you putting up with or pretending to like from duty or obligation? Consult your resentment. It's a revelatory emotion for all its pathology. It's part of an evil triad. Arrogance, deceit, and resentment. Nothing causes more harm than this underworld trinity. But resentment always means one of two things. Either the resentful person is immature, in which case he or she should shut up, quit whining, and get on with it, or there is tyranny afoot, in which case the person subjugated has a moral obligation to speak up. Why? Because the consequence of remaining silent is worse. Of course, it's easier in the moment to stay silent and avoid conflict, but in the long term, that's deadly. When you have something to say, silence is a lie, and tyranny feeds on lies. When should you push back against oppression, despite the danger? When you start nursing secret fantasies of revenge. When your life is being poisoned and your imagination fills with the wish to devour and destroy. I had a client decades ago who suffered from severe obsessive compulsive disorder. He had to line up his pajamas just right before he could go to sleep at night. Then he had to fluff his pillow. Then he had to adjust the bed sheets over and over and over and over. I said, maybe that part of you, that insanely persistent part, wants something, inarticulate though it may be. Let it have its say. What could it be? He said, control. I said, close your eyes and let it tell you what it wants. Don't let fear stop you. You don't have to act it out just because you're thinking it. He said, it wants me to take my stepfather by the collar, put him up against the door, and shake him like a rat. Maybe it was time to shake someone like a rat, although I suggested something a bit less primal. But God only knows what battles must be fought forthrightly, voluntarily, on the road to peace. What do you do to avoid conflict, necessary though it may be? What are you inclined to lie about, assuming that the truth might be intolerable? What do you fake? The infant is dependent on his parents for almost everything he needs. The child, the successful child, can leave his parents, at least temporarily, and make friends. He gives up a little of himself to do that, but gains much in return. The successful adolescent must take that process to its logical conclusion. He has to leave his parents and become like everyone else. He has to integrate with the group so he can transcend his childhood dependency. Once integrated, the successful adult then must learn how to be just the right amount different from everyone else. Be cautious when you're comparing yourself to others. You're a singular being once you're an adult. You have your own particular, specific problems, financial, intimate, psychological, and otherwise. Those are embedded in the unique, broader context of your existence. Your career or job works for you in a personal manner, or it does not. And it does so in a unique interplay with the other specifics of your life. You must decide how much of your time to spend on this and how much on that. You must decide what to let go and what to pursue. The point of our eyes, or take stock. Our eyes are always pointing at things we are interested in approaching or investigating or looking for or having. We must see. But to see We must aim. So we are always aiming. Our minds are built on the hunting and gathering platforms of our bodies. To hunt is to specify a target, track it, and throw at it. To gather is to specify and to grasp. We fling stones and spears and boomerangs. We toss balls through hoops and hit pucks into nets and curl carved granite rocks down the ice onto horizontal bullseyes. We launch projectiles at targets with bows, guns, rifles, and rockets. We hurl insults, launch plans, and pitch ideas. We succeed when we score a goal or hit a target. We fail or sin when we do not, as the word sin means to miss the mark. We cannot navigate without something to aim at, and while we are in this world, we must always navigate. We are always and simultaneously at point A, which is less desirable than it could be, moving towards point B, which we deem better in accordance with our explicit and implicit values. We always encounter the world in a state of insufficiency and seek its correction. We can imagine new ways that things could be set right and improved, even if we have everything we thought we needed. Even when satisfied, temporarily, we remain curious. We live within a framework that defines the present as eternally lacking and the future as eternally better. If we did not see things this way, we would not act at all. We wouldn't even be able to see, because to see, we must focus, and to focus, we must pick one thing above all else on which to focus. But we can see. We can even see things that aren't there. We can envision new ways that things could be better. We can construct new hypothetical worlds where problems we weren't even aware of can now show themselves and be addressed. The advantages of this are obvious. We can change the world so that the intolerable state of the present can be rectified in the future. The disadvantage to all this foresight and creativity is chronic unease and discomfort. Because we always contrast what is with what could be, we have to aim at what could be. But we can aim too high, or too low, or too chaotically. So we fail, and live in disappointment, even when we appear to others to be living well. How can we benefit from our imaginativeness, our ability to improve the future, without continually denigrating our current, insufficiently successful and worthless lives? The first step, perhaps, is to take stock. Who are you? When you buy a house and prepare to live in it, you hire an inspector to list all its faults, as it is, in reality, now, not as you wish it could be. You'll even pay him for the bad news. You need to know. You need to discover the home's hidden flaws. You need to know whether they are cosmetic imperfections or structural inadequacies. You need to know, because you can't fix something if you don't know it's broken. And you're broken. You need an inspector. The internal critic, it could play that role if you could get it on track, if you and it could cooperate. It could help you take stock, but you must walk through your psychological house with it and listen judiciously to what it says. Maybe you're a handyman's dream, a real fixer-upper. How can you start your renovations without being demoralized, even crushed by your internal critic's lengthy and painful report of your inadequacies? Here's a hint. The future is like the past, but there's a crucial difference. The past is fixed, but the future, it could be better. It could be better, some precise amount, the amount that can be achieved perhaps in a day with some minimal engagement. The present is eternally flawed, but where you start might not be as important as the direction you are heading. Perhaps happiness is always to be found in the journey uphill, and not in the fleeting sense of satisfaction awaiting at the next peak. Much of happiness is hope, no matter how deep the underworld in which that hope was conceived. Called upon properly, the internal critic will suggest something to set in order, which you could set in order, which you would set in order, voluntarily, without resentment, even with pleasure. Ask yourself, is there one thing that exists in disarray in your life or your situation that you could and would set straight? Could you and would you Fix that one thing that announces itself humbly in need of repair. Could you do it now? Imagine that you are someone with whom you must negotiate. Imagine further that you're lazy, touchy, resentful, and hard to get along with. With that attitude, it's not going to be easy to get you moving. You might have to use a little charm and playfulness. Excuse me, you might say to yourself, without irony or sarcasm. I'm trying to reduce some of the unnecessary suffering around here. I could use some help. Keep the derision at bay. I'm wondering if there's anything that you would be willing to do. I'd be very grateful for your service. Ask honestly and with humility. That's no simple matter. You might have to negotiate further, depending on your state of mind. Maybe you don't trust yourself. You think that you'll ask yourself for one thing, and having delivered, immediately demand more. And you'll be punitive and hurtful about it, and you'll denigrate what was already offered. Who wants to work for a tyrant like that? Not you. That's why you don't do what you want yourself to do. You're a bad employee, but a worse boss. Maybe you need to say to yourself, okay, I know we haven't gotten along very well in the past. Sorry about that. I'm trying to improve. I'll probably make some more mistakes along the way, but I'll try to listen if you object. I'll try to learn. I noticed just now today that you weren't really jumping at the opportunity to help when I asked. Is there something I could offer in return for your cooperation? Maybe if you did the dishes, we could go for coffee. You like espresso? How about an espresso? Maybe a double shot? Or is there something else you want? Then you could listen. Maybe you'll hear a voice inside. Maybe it's even the voice of a long-lost child. Maybe it will reply, really? You really want to do something nice for me? You really do it? It's not a trick? This is where you must be careful. That little voice, that's the voice of someone once burnt and twice shy. So you could say very carefully, really, I might not do it very well, and I might not be great company, but I will do something nice for you. I promise. A little careful kindness goes a long way, and judicious reward is a powerful motivator. Then you could take that small bit of yourself by the hand and do the damn dishes. And then you better not go clean the bathroom and forget about the coffee or the movie or the beer, or it will be even harder to call those forgotten parts of yourself forth from the nooks and crannies of the underworld. You might ask yourself, what could I say to someone else? My friend, my brother, my boss, my assistant, that would set things a bit more right between us tomorrow? What bit of chaos might I eradicate at home, on my desk, in my kitchen, tonight, so that the stage could be set for a better play? What snakes might I banish from my closet and my mind? 500 small decisions, 500 tiny actions compose your day, today and every day. Could you aim one or two of those at a better result? Better in your own private opinion, by your own individual standards. Could you compare your specific personal tomorrow with your specific personal yesterday? Could you use your own judgment and ask yourself what that better tomorrow might be? Aim small. You don't want to shoulder too much to begin with, given your limited talents, tendency to deceive, burden of resentment, and ability to shirk responsibility. Thus, you set the following goal. By the end of the day, I want things in my life to be a tiny bit better than they were this morning. Then you ask yourself, what could I do that I would do that would accomplish that? And what small thing would I like as a reward? Then you do what you have decided to do, even if you do it badly. Then you give yourself that damn coffee in triumph. Maybe you feel a bit stupid about it, but you do it anyway. And you do the same thing tomorrow, and the next day, and the next. And with each day, your baseline of comparison gets a little higher. And that's magic. That's compound interest. Do that for 3 years and your life will be entirely different. Now you're aiming for something higher. Now you're wishing on a star. Now the beam is disappearing from your eye and you're learning to see. And what you aim at determines what you see. That's worth repeating. What you aim at determines what you see. what you want, and what you see. The dependency of sight on aim, and therefore on value, because you aim at what you value, was demonstrated unforgettably by the cognitive psychologist Daniel Simons more than 15 years ago. Simons was investigating something called sustained inattentional blindness. He would sit his research subjects in front of a video monitor and show them, for example, a field of wheat. Then he would transform the photo slowly, secretly, while they watched. He would slowly fade in a road cutting through the wheat. He didn't insert some little easy-to-miss footpath either. It was a major trail, occupying a good third of the image. Remarkably, the observers would frequently fail to take notice. The demonstration that made Dr. Simons famous was of the same kind, but more dramatic, even unbelievable. First, he produced a video of two teams of three people. One team was wearing white shirts, the other black. The two teams were not off in the distance either, or in any way difficult to see. The six of them filled much of the video screen, and their facial features were close enough to see clearly. Each team had its own ball, which they bounced or threw to their other team members, as they moved and feinted in the small space in front of the elevators where the game was filmed. Once Dan had his video, he showed it to his study participants. He asked each of them to count the number of times the white shirts threw the ball back and forth to one another. After a few minutes, his subjects were asked to report the number of passes. Most answered 15. That was the correct answer. Most felt pretty good about that. Ha! They passed the test. But then Dr. Simons asked, "Did you see the gorilla?" "Was this a joke? What gorilla?" So he said, "Watch the video again. But this time, don't count." Sure enough, a minute or so in, a man dressed in a gorilla suit waltzes right into the middle of the game for a few long seconds, stops, and then beats his chest in the manner of stereotyped gorillas everywhere, right in the middle of the screen. Large as life, painfully and irrefutably evident. But one out of every two of his research subjects missed it the first time they saw the video. It gets worse. Dr. Simons did another study. This time he showed his subjects a video of someone being served at a counter. The server dips behind the counter to retrieve something and pops back up. So what? Most of his participants don't detect anything amiss. But it was a different person who stood up in the original server's place. No way, you think. I'd notice. But it's yes way. There's a high probability you wouldn't detect the change, even if the gender or race of the person is switched at the same time. You're blind, too. This is partly because vision is expensive, psychophysiologically expensive, neurologically expensive. Very little of your retina is high-resolution fovea, the very central high-resolution part of the eye, used to do such things as identify faces. Each of the scarce foveal cells needs 10,000 cells in the visual cortex merely to manage the first part of the multi-stage process of seeing. Then each of those 10,000 requires 10,000 more just to get to stage 2. If all your retina was fovea, you would require the skull of a B-movie alien to house your brain. In consequence, we triage when we see. Most of our vision is peripheral and low resolution. We save the fovea for things of importance. We point our high-resolution capacities at the few specific things we are aiming at, and we let everything else, which is almost everything, fade unnoticed into the background. If something you're not attending to pops its ugly head up in a manner that directly interferes with your narrowly focused current activity, you will see it. Otherwise, it's just not there. The ball on which Simon's research subjects were focused was never obscured by the gorilla or by any of the six players. Because of that, because the gorilla did not interfere with the ongoing narrowly defined task, it was indistinguishable from everything else the participants didn't see when they were looking at the ball. The big ape could be safely ignored. That's how you deal with the overwhelming complexity of the world. You ignore it, while you concentrate minutely on your private concerns. You see things that facilitate your movement forward toward your desired goals. You detect obstacles when they pop up in your path. You're blind to everything else, and there's a lot of everything else, so you're very blind. And it has to be that way, because there is much more of the world than there is of you. You must shepherd your limited resources carefully. Seeing is very difficult, so you must choose what to see and let the rest go. There's a profound idea in the ancient Vedic texts, the oldest scriptures of Hinduism and part of the bedrock of Indian culture. The world as perceived is Maya, appearance or illusion. This means in part that people are blinded by their desires, as well as merely incapable of seeing things as they truly are. This is true in a sense that transcends the metaphorical. Your eyes are tools. They are there to help you get what you want. The price you pay for that utility, that specific focused direction, is blindness to everything else. This doesn't matter so much when things are going well and we are getting what we want, although it can be a problem even then because getting what we currently want can make us blind to higher callings. But all that ignored world presents a truly terrible problem when we're in crisis and nothing whatsoever is turning out the way we want it to. Then there can be far too much to deal with. Happily, however, that problem contains within it the seeds of its own solution. Since you've ignored so much, there is plenty of possibility left where you have not yet looked. Imagine that you're unhappy. You're not getting what you need. Perversely, this may be because of what you want. You are blind because of what you desire. Perhaps what you really need is right in front of your eyes, but you cannot see it because of what you are currently aiming for. And that brings us to something else. The price that must be paid before you or anyone can get what they want, or better yet, what they need. Think about it this way. You look at the world in your particular idiosyncratic manner. You use a set of tools to screen most things out and let some things in. You've spent a lot of time building those tools. They've become habitual. They're not mere abstract thoughts. They're built right into you. They orient you in the world. They're your deepest and often implicit and unconscious values. They've become part of your biological structure. They're alive. And they don't want to disappear or transform or die. But sometimes their time has come and new things need to be born. For this reason, although not only for this reason, it is necessary to let things go during the journey uphill. If things are not going well for you, well, that might be because, as the most cynical of aphorisms has it, life sucks and then you die. Before your crisis impels you to that hideous conclusion, however, you might consider the following. Life doesn't have the problem. You do. At least that realization leaves you with some options. If your life is not going well, perhaps it is your current knowledge that is insufficient, not life itself. Perhaps your value structure needs some serious retooling. Perhaps what you want is blinding you to what else could be. Perhaps you are holding on to your desires in the present so tightly that you cannot see anything else, even what you truly need. Imagine that you're thinking enviously, "I should have my boss's job." If your boss sticks to his post stubbornly and competently, thoughts like that will lead you into a state of irritation, unhappiness, and disgust. You might realize this. You think, "I am unhappy. However, I could be cured of this unhappiness if I could just fulfill my ambition." But then you might think further. "Wait," you think. "Maybe I'm not unhappy because I don't have my boss's job. Maybe I'm unhappy because I can't stop wanting that job." That doesn't mean you can just simply and magically tell yourself to stop wanting that job and then listen and transform. You won't. Can't, in fact, just change yourself that easily. You have to dig deeper. You must change what you are after more profoundly. So you might think, "I don't know what to do about this stupid suffering. I can't just abandon my ambitions. That would leave me nowhere to go. But my longing for a job that I can't have isn't working." You might decide to take a different tack. You might ask instead for the revelation of a different plan. One that would fulfill your desires and gratify your ambitions in a real sense, but that would remove from your life the bitterness and resentment with which you are currently affected. You might think, I will make a different plan. I will try to want whatever it is that would make my life better, whatever that might be, and I will start working on it now. If that turns out to mean something other than chasing my boss's job, I will accept that, and I will move forward. Now you're on a whole different kind of trajectory. Before, what was right, desirable, and worthy of pursuit was something narrow and concrete. But you became stuck there, tightly jammed and unhappy. So you let go. You make the necessary sacrifice and allow a whole new world of possibility, hidden from you because of your previous ambition, to reveal itself. And there's a lot there. What would your life look like?